Good afternoon, and welcome to a very special event here at West Virginia Wesleyan College. Today, we are honored to welcome home the 12th president of West Virginia Wesleyan College and our senior U.S. Senator from West Virginia, John D. Rockefeller IV, and distinguished journalist Ted Koppel. I could stop there, but I won't. This is indeed an honor for all of us associated with the college. I know you will enjoy what promises to be a very stimulating and inspiring discussion. As you entered the auditorium, you received a note card and a commemorative pen, which we hope you'll enjoy as a keepsake. If you wish to ask Senator Rockefeller a question after his conversation with Mr. Koppel, please go ahead and complete the card and we'll collect it. While not all questions will be selected for today's program, those that are not chosen will be answered online at Senator Rockefeller's website. Also, you are invited to attend a reception in the Greek Alumni Room immediately following this afternoon's program. Senator Jay Rockefeller has proudly served the people of West Virginia for more than 40 years. Jay first came to West Virginia in 1964 as a 27-year-old Vista volunteer serving in a small mining community of Emmons. A graduate of Harvard with a BA in Far Eastern Languages and History, he was elected to the House of Delegates in 1966 and to the office of West Virginia Secretary of State in 1968. After serving as president of West Virginia Wesleyan from 1973 to 1975, Jay was elected governor of West Virginia in 1976 and reelected in 1980. In 1984, he was elected to the United States Senate and then reelected in 1990, 96, 2002, and 2008. Senator Rockefeller is the chairman of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Transportation. He is also the chairman of the Health Care Subcommittee on Finance and a member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And he also serves on the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. Senator Rockefeller has enjoyed a distinguished career in public service with a lifelong commitment to improving the lives of all West Virginians and all Americans. Ted Koppel, in March 2012, the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University named Ted Koppel one of the 100 outstanding journalists in the United States in the last 100 years. Ted was the youngest full-time correspondent ever hired by ABC News. And by the time he left the network 42 years later, he was the most honored reporter in the network's history. Ted was the anchor and the managing editor of Nightline over a period of 26 years, or roughly 6,000 programs, making him the longest-serving news anchor in broadcast network history. He received 42 Emmy Awards and numerous other honors. These days, he works as a news analyst for NPR and a contributing columnist to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, all of which goes to explain why you should not ask Grace Ann, his wife of 50 years, how she is enjoying Ted's retirement. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Wesleyan welcome to Ted Koppel and Senator Jay Rockefeller.
We are a pretty amazing pair.
I know.
Oh, isn't that extraordinary? Wow.
I have no Emmys.
I have no committees.
I have one Sharon, but no Emmys.
Yeah. About a year ago, Bill O'Reilly and John Stewart had a debate. Some of you may remember that. Now, Bill is about 6'4", and John is about 5'7". And John arranged to have this little platform that rose during the debate.
Really?
Yeah. I was kind of hoping that you would arrange one of those for me. But instead, we're sinking into chairs that make me even shorter and make the senator normal size. All right. I want to begin by reminding you of what people thought of your family when I was a kid. The Rockefellers were rich. The Rockefellers were Republican. John D. Rockefeller, your great-grandfather, was the very personification of capitalism. So what in heaven's name turned you into a Democrat and one who came down here to West Virginia to serve in 1964,
yeah.
Right? You came down and were you in the Peace Corps first or in Vista first?
I was in the Peace Corps before 1964, and I worked for the State Department before 1964.
And then Vista.
But then Vista in 64.
Very un-Rockefeller-like.
I think so.
Why?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that all of the women in my generation in the Rockefeller family, and there are many more women than men, they have all, including all three of my sisters, when they were in their teens, they dropped their last name of Rockefeller. It was just not a good name to have. It put many impediments into their relationships at school and elsewhere. And so they dropped it. And to this day, none of them have taken it back. And it's partly because of this. I mean, it's when you hear the name Rockefeller, a lot of people think of the Ludlow Massacre. Do you know what the Ludlow Massacre is? Well, it was out in Colorado. My grandfather was a part of the board of directors of a mine which sort of collapsed, caught on fire, and 12 people were killed. And it changed him enormously. There was a liberal prime minister of Canada called Mackenzie King.
Remember?
For whatever reason, they were very, very good friends. My grandfather called Mackenzie King. He said, come help me sort out what I need to do because the people hate me here. They hate me here. And Mackenzie King said, and many other places, most other places, Mackenzie King said, be natural if you can do that, which was hard for my grandfather to do. He was sort of stiff by nature. But dance with the ladies, be of good humor, and work on how it is that unions and corporations can come together to form some plan for cooperating rather than going after each other, going on strike and Pinkerton detectives and all this kind of thing. And they actually came up with a plan. I have two copies that I possess. One I gave to Richard Trumka, who was the former president of the United Mine Workers of America and is now the head of the AFL-CIO. And the other I keep for myself. But it's a plan for management and labor to get along. It was the first one ever put out, particularly by such a strong capitalist as my grandfather. But in all of that, Ted, there is a deeper thing. And that is that my grandfather didn't really want to take the role of just being a Rockefeller, going to the Rockefeller family offices and giving away money. And he did a lot of that. But he wanted something more. And in a funny way, Colonial Williamsburg is what kind of turned him around. It became his project. Rockefeller Center became his project. But the problem was, and it was my father faced it, John D. Rockefeller III, I faced it. I was expected to go into the family offices. I didn't want to do that. I'm not a business person. I'm not a financial person. I'm not claiming poverty, but I'm just saying I'm not very good at that stuff. And I wanted to do something larger than life. And I wanted to do something really, really hard. The problem was how to get to that point. So I'm going to give about a 3-minute monologue here, and Ted can interrupt me anytime he wants. I went to Harvard, as was said by President Balch. I didn't like Harvard. This was back in the 1950s. In fact, I hated Harvard because the whole trick back then was getting in. And if you had a good background and all that stuff, you got in. But once you got in, they forgot you were there. There was none of the sort of the Wesleyan feeling that I remember so well as president of people being there for each other. And so at the end of my junior year, I said, I'm not going to graduate from this place feeling somnolent or sleepy, which is what America was. It was after the Korean War, before the Vietnam War. I didn't want to be a person without a mission or a person who's just automatically followed into the family work. And so I walked into my Japanese professor's office one day and said, I want to be in Japan in 2 weeks. I'd been to Japan before. I cared a lot about Japan. And I went there, and at the time, that was 1957, I was really the only, other than military and diplomatic, I was the only American there. And I went to a school whose only mission was to teach me Japanese language and to teach Japanese students the English language. It's now the most popular school in Japan, university in Japan. So I spent 3 years slaving to learn 3,600 ideographs, kanji as they call them, and learning how to speak and read and write Japanese. But what the real effect of being in Japan was, it was only 12 years after the end of the Second World War, and they were flat on their backs. They had nothing to turn to. They had no sort of larger prospect in front of them. But they were grinders. They survived. I remember going to one farm, which was the 39th generation of that family to work that farm. So the sense of history, the sense of obligation to history, to oneself, to one's family, all that kind of thing. But it changed me dramatically. I lived in the middle of a rice field with four other Japanese roommates in a wood and paper house. And it just changed me. It didn't make me a Democrat or a Republican because I wasn't really interested in any of that at that point. But I came back and I finished up at Harvard and I sort of liked my senior year. I worked hard and I did all the things I should have done my first year. But then I didn't even go to my graduation. I went off to Yale to study the Chinese language because that was the obvious comer in Asia. But it would have taken me 5 years. And I got a letter from a guy named, how many of you have ever heard the name Sergeant Shriver? Sergeant Shriver is my all-time hero, other than Ted Koppel, of course. Most of the things that the Kennedy family did were his ideas. Most of the ideas which they supported, he put into practice. He was the most impressive administrator. He should have been president of the United States. Anyway, I got a letter from him when I was at Yale saying, come join the Peace Corps. And so I did. And that, it was the Philippines. And that, again, way outside the box, way outside my comfort zone, way outside of what I was accustomed to. And But I learned their ways, their habits, if not their language. And I came back and I was clearly changing. It wasn't just about, my family or what job am I going to have or whatever. It instilled in me a desire to do something important and something hard. I didn't know it was going to be public service. I have a very good friend named Charlie Peters, who's a West Virginian, who Ted knows very well, who said, Jay, it's about time you learn something about your own country. Enough of Asia already. And so that's when I became a VISTA volunteer in Emmons, in Kanawha and Boone County, for 2 years in southern West Virginia, which completely changed me. Because there, in 156 families, I think there was one person had a job. Nobody had health care. Nobody had anything. It was they didn't even send a school bus out there to pick up the junior high or the high school kids because they said it's just too far away. And so it was sort of Emmons against the world. And it occurred in me a kind of an anger and a rage because I really liked those kids. I liked those parents. And yet they were being shunted aside by the system, in this case, the Kanawha County.
Senator, let me interrupt you for a moment because I want to learn a little bit more about what was going on in your head at the time. 1964, you should know, was the year that Barry Goldwater was the Republican candidate for president. Mm-hmm. Your uncle, Nelson, tried to run against him and got steamrollered out in San Francisco at the convention. It was the first political convention I ever covered. When I say the Rockefellers were a Republican family, that man, Nelson Rockefeller, very nearly, on a couple of occasions, became president of the United States. He was what was known as the middle-of-the-road, moderate Republican. And I would still like to know, I mean, you know, all those years in Japan, studying Chinese, the time you spent in the Philippines, none of that could have prepared you for life in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. Was that the moment that you changed, or was the change part of a sort of long-standing development where you began by feeling a certain discomfort that you said your sisters clearly felt with the name? Did you have that same discomfort?
No, I've never had any discomfort with the name Rockefeller. I think with the women in the family, it was the fact that men might date them for the wrong reasons.
I've got to tell you a very quick story. On a far lesser level, I have three daughters, one son. And it would happen back in the days when I was doing Nightline. One of my daughters dates at one point. Spent the whole evening asking her about me. And to her enormous credit, after about 45 minutes of this, she took out a pen and a piece of paper, scribbled something on it, and said, "Here's my father's number. You want to date him? Call him."
Now, I think in my case, everything in my life has been really kind of rational, except if you look at it closely. I didn't want to live in New York City. I didn't want to be a financier. I do philanthropy, but I didn't want to make it the center of my life. I wanted to be involved with people as I was in Japan, as I was in the Philippines, but I wanted them to be here in the United States. And I wanted to be involved with people who were always, as I would say, pushing a rock. When you push a rock uphill, a big rock, if you, for 1 second, take either hand off the rock to itch your nose or something, you all go down into Hades, right? Down into the abyss. And that's what I wanted. I wanted something that was almost impossible to do, but that I would have a chance of trying to do it, which was to give the people in Emmons and later on on a larger scale in West Virginia and even in the country a sense that that life can be better and that if we work together, we have an America, you know, we always talk about Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan as being tribal. They can't get along because they're tribals. They're Sunnis or they're Shiites or whatever. We have a lot of that in this country, too. It has to do with class. It has to do with where you live, how you were brought up, how you talk, how you look, how you dress. Do you carry a nice pocketbook when you go to high school, or do you not? Nobody at Emmons had a pocketbook, period. And they were brutally teased for that when they finally went to George Washington High School, which was the worst place in the state that that they could have been sent to. But I wanted, so I decided to become a social worker. I really liked the people of Emmons, the kids in particular. The parents were standoffish to me. To them, I was a carpetbagger, as I was to the rest of the state. What are you doing here? What is this? What is this? Go away. My life is bad enough. I don't want you to make it worse. And so I just, we started a community organization. We had piano classes. We had a library. We had a baseball team that played 24 games in 2 years and lost every single one of them because nobody had ever had a ball or a batter. It didn't matter. We came together. We came together. And I saw in that the potential for a larger scene. So, Ted, past is prologue. What I experienced in the aggregate between Japan, the Philippines, but particularly Japan and Emmons, West Virginia, and particularly Emmons, West Virginia, told me what I wanted to do. I wanted to go into something called public service. That's why I'm here, is to proselytize briefly, and Ted will make sure of that, on public service and the value of public service. So many people do what their parents do, what their father does, what their mother does, and they don't put themselves outside of their comfort zone. I'm a strong believer that unless you, if you go to a country, and many universities do this, and maybe Wesleyan does, where they send, as a matter of curricula, they send their students overseas for a full year to Africa or to Asia or to South America. So they see how other people live, because other people don't live like Americans. Nobody lives like Americans. And that's where you get this sense of tapestry, of richness, of the promise of life, the futility of life, the despair of life, all the emotions from good to very, very bad. But I wanted to take them on, and so I became a social worker. Am I trained as a social worker? Absolutely not. Was I effective as a social worker? Probably not, but boy, did I try. And I kept a diary, Ted, for every day I was there, and it's over 500 pages long, 83 lines of Olivetti typewriter per thing.
Did you ever publish?
No, in fact, it was sort of like a sacred document to me. I didn't even read it until last summer, 50 years later.
I want to interrupt you for a moment. And again, let me tell a quick story just to illustrate a point. It's the story about this young Hollywood star, very handsome, goes out to dinner with his agent. And he spends half an hour talking about himself, how terrific he is, what great movies he's made, how all the young starlets love him. And then finally, about a half hour into the dinner, he says to the agent, "But enough about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think about me?" "I want you to talk about them. I want you to explain to them why a life of public service, I mean, I need to remind all of you out there, those of you who are younger, that in the 1960s, when the Kennedys were in power, and Sarge Shriver created the Peace Corps, this notion of public service was a hot item."
It was.
"It's not today. Talk about that a little bit and tell some of these young people why they should. We've been moving in an opposite direction in this country over the last few years."
The reason is because we can't move forward as a country until we coalesce on certain principles that we can agree on and allow us to spend. For example, there's this thing going around Washington now that you can't spend money. And I'm thinking about these 200,000 pound water trucks that are setting up for fracking. And they go across 75,000 pound bridges in West Virginia and just squash them, or they go through people's front yards. We're on a money chase. We're on a stardom chase. Neither Ted nor I could have made it in television because we're not handsome enough.
That's true.
No, it's true. You have to be beautiful, you have to be handsome, and you have to and hopefully you'll know something. But that's not the first requirement.
That's not even asked about anymore. You don't have to know anything.
You don't have to know anything.
You just have to have an opinion.
What I want is for you to, what I'm here for is to try and get you to feel fantastic about yourself after a period of years in which you commit yourself to helping other people's lives get better. In whatever mode, it does not have to be in politics. I had a fellow named Jimmy Fox. Any of you from Wood County? That's impossible. He worked for me in my office in the Senate, and he said he wanted to get into politics. And of course, he immediately said, oh, I want to be a senator, I wanted to be a governor. I said, hold on. You want to do good. If you run for one of those two positions, your chances of getting it are small. You'll have to raise a lot of money. You'll probably have to compromise some of your principles. Why don't you get interested in your school board, your county board of education, and make that your pursuit? And he did. And he was on it for years. He may still be on it. I don't know. But the whole concept of if you're in public life that you have to be a governor or a senator or something of that sort is nonsense. It's totally nonsense. You can be in public life as a social worker. My state boss over here, Rocky Goodwin, has spent every waking day of her life, except when she has been working for me recently, as a legal aid. That's what she does. She graduated from WV Law School and went right into legal aid, and she never strayed, and she'll probably go right back to it. Doing good for people, does it pay a lot? No. Is the satisfaction a lot? Yes. Does it make her feel like she's improving other people's lives? Yes, it does. So being in public life doesn't have to be glamorous. It probably isn't glamorous. People despise people in public life. People despise the Congress. I'm surprised that we're as high as 9%. But I don't care about that. I don't care about that because there's always something called public policy. Public policy is unendingly interesting. Now, I'll give you two examples. One is, I'll just call it the E-rate. And you know what it is. It's the way the whole computer thing started in the schools. It wasn't actually a computer hooked up to a connectivity. It was just putting the connectivity in the classroom. And a Republican from Maine named Olympia Snow and I passed that in 1996. At that time, 14% of the classrooms in America were connected to the internet. And now the number is about 94% all across this country, and we're going for 99% because particularly in the more very rural areas, it's really, really hard to get broadband and get connectivity, much less, you know, the equipment in there. People can't afford it. People who can afford computers at homes have an advantage over people who have it at schools. On the other hand, that's the reason why we made public libraries part of a schoolroom, because it meant that adults can't go to school, but they can go to the public library, and they do frequently. And you go to a public library here in Upshur County, and you'll see people lined up trying to get jobs or trying to get information about this or that or the other thing. But that took years and years and years. And that was 1996. It took a long time to get it done. And now I'm back and trying to get it expanded. I'm trying to get it expanded so it covers everything at a much greater rate because the demand is twice as great as the resources. But there's a thing in Washington, you can't raise money because that's called raising taxes. Well, what are you going to get done about roads or bridges or science or research of any sort if you don't have money to do it? The first institution, I think, in this country to get federal money was Johns Hopkins University. But that wasn't until fairly recently. I mean, the feds didn't do that. Fed should have been doing that because the private sector and individuals can't do that. It's too expensive. So you fight for that. So we're going to get this expanded E-rate, and it's going to make your children and you have a much richer experience generally in life.
Senator, let me ask you about something that may discourage a lot of young people from going into public service. As they look at Washington today, it's a partisan jungle. The level of nastiness exceeds anything I've seen in 50 years as a journalist. And frankly, the idea of getting into politics, if somebody wanted one of my kids or grandkids to get into politics, I'd say think again. Now, you're not talking about politics, you're talking about public service, but the two are related. Talk a little bit about what's happened to this country over the last, pick a time period, 20 years? Why are things so ugly today?
I have to be a little political when I say this, but it wasn't ugly 15 years ago. And I had many of my best friends were Republicans, both on committees that I served and on the floor. And we worked together very well on things and passed things. Pamela, I remember we passed a $44 billion bill. Lamar Alexander, Jay Rockefeller, and one other person. Who was that? One other person. In the center of the Senate floor. And I was chairman of the committee, so I could speak for the committee, and I said it was a $45 billion project. Kay Bailey Hutchinson from Texas, who was a wonderful Republican. And she said, it's a little rich for me. So I said, let's take a billion off. And she said, well, I don't like this particular program. And I called up the head of the Commerce Committee staff, and I said, is that program really important? She said, no. I went back, and I said, it's gone. And then all of a sudden, we had an agreement, $44 billion agreement for math, science, technology, and engineering, which is the future of this country. And that's coming up again for a vote. I think the Tea Party had something to do with it. The liberals became so liberal, conservatives became so conservative that there wasn't really any talking with them. And nobody would compromise. Compromise was considered and is considered a dirty word. What is my reaction to that? Very bland. I go ahead and I do my work. Because regardless of the atmosphere, regardless of the hostility, if you're fair with people, if you're down the middle with them, there's a fellow that is other senior guy in the Commerce Committee named John Thune. He's from South Dakota. He's in the Republican leadership. So he should be behaving as a Republican leadership. He doesn't, because he and I are friends. We're just friends. I mean, we talk sports, we talk whatever it is. We're friends. We like each other. And so there's a natural inclination to accommodate each other so as to not embarrass each other. If he wants to get something through, I try to help him with his membership or with my membership. And it works, and it leaves a lasting impression. Has it affected the Congress as a whole? No. I don't think that'll last another 10 years. I think in 10 years we'll be right back to where we are now.
Talk a little bit about how media has affected that.
No, that's what you're going to talk about, because I love it. I love it when you do it.
If they want to hear it. We're here to listen to you right now.
Well, now that...
Well,
will you say at least a word?
I'll say a word. I'll tell you what. I'll say a couple of minutes worth, but only that.
Media is a great detriment to this whole process, because media, it's like if somebody's murdered or raped or assaulted or broken into in Florida or California or Cedar Rapids, Iowa, you know, it doesn't make any difference. The news is all over it. And this is going to make me sound very, very callous, and I want to apologize in advance for it, because I've been to Malaysia a number of times, and I like it. But was it necessary that we have two consecutive months of following as the lead story on the news the condition of the beeps from down under when those people were clearly dead and they were clearly underwater dead and the question was finding the plane. That soaked up all the oxygen in the news world. Or if, as I say, if somebody is assaulted or there's a criminal this or a conflict of that sort, the news is all over it. And they want to say, well, which side are you on? Which side are you on? And often it isn't necessarily a side. It's somewhere in between. But they're not interested in that. And if you don't give them something dramatic, then you don't appear on television. I have made a practice in my public life of not really caring about whether I appear on television or not, or whether I appear in the newspapers or not. You will very rarely see me on any Sunday shows. Ted never invited me onto his show.
You're too tall.
I was too tall, yeah. But I think that's an advantage. In other words, if people go into public life, public service, whatever you want to call it, or politics, for seeing their face on television, write them off. Now, campaigns are different. You got to do it. But it's awful, isn't it? All this endless money in politics, it's awful. I'm not running again. I'm so glad I'm not running again. For that reason, I'm going to desperately miss the policy. And I'm going to desperately keep in touch with my staff and the people that I've worked with over the years. But I, you know, the whole political thing has been turned into a food fight and who can stamp on who. And I don't respect that. I don't participate in that. And I think that's one reason. I think West Virginians understand that. I'm not a publicity monger. I do my work. And sometimes people agree with me and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they let me know. For example, I'm a very strong proponent of the Affordable Care Act. I helped write it. I know everything in it. I put a lot of stuff in it. And the amazing thing is West Virginia will get more out of that bill when it folds out than any other state in the country. But if people don't agree with my position on it, I don't get angry at them because I understand that's the currency. Because the media loves to pick on, you know, it's particularly I guess Fox, they like to pick on the Affordable Care Act and what went wrong today. Oh, and the president got to 8 billion, so what? And there's just a cynicism about anything that might even be do the country good because it has to be done for a political reason. Well, this wasn't done for a political reason. I mean, there's a program which I love called the Children's Health Insurance Program, which gives 37,000 kids in West Virginia insurance and 8 million kids in the United States insurance. I can remember, and this is what you got to be prepared for. I can remember, Ted, for a period of 2 years, that Chuck Grassley and Max Baucus, who was chairman of the Finance Committee, I was next to him on the Finance Committee, and Orrin Hatch, met every afternoon from 5 o'clock until 7 o'clock every single day for 2 years until we finally hammered out a children's health insurance bill, which has been a savior for so many people. But that's what you have to do. And you have your ups and downs. Orrin Hatch storms out or I storm out or something, whatever it is. But you keep coming back to the table. You keep coming back to the table.
But what's been happening in politics, Senator, is that those Republicans, or at least many of them, like your friend Olympia Snowe, have become so disillusioned by the nastiness of the politics that being someone who is willing to compromise, being someone who is willing to sit there for 2 hours every afternoon and reach across the aisle and try to come up with solutions, that doesn't get you reelected. Quite the contrary, it gets you knocked out. Who's the great Republican senator from Indiana? I'm having a
Dick Lugar.
Dick Lugar should have been reelected. He should have been, but he wasn't. Dick Lugar was a great U.S. senator. You agree?
I agree. His problem was that he specialized in overseas matters, in foreign affairs. and he was the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And what I remember when I came into the Senate, there had never been a senator in the history of West Virginia who had voted for any foreign aid assistance to any other country. The thing to do was to vote no and then go out and campaign. I voted against giving any money to, you know, Indonesia or whatever it was. I've never voted against a foreign aid bill, I don't think, because I think the world has gotten very small. It's very, very dangerous. The work on the Intelligence Committee is very, very scary. And things are always potentially very imminent.
And tell folks, if you can, what is the percentage of our budget, our overall budget? It's less than 1%, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say 1%, but if it's less than that. President Balch, I remember one time I had a crisis here at Wesleyan because the faculty was furious because they felt, no, they were furious. The faculty senate was furious at the fact that they felt I was spending too much money on athletics. So what I did was I just opened up the books. I opened up the books, and they got to see for themselves that the total budget for athletics at West Virginia Wesleyan in 1973, 74, 75 was 2%. I didn't hear a peep. Just being open. We're going through that now on the Intelligence Committee. You've read a lot about torture, right? That Americans in the Afghan War and the Iraqi War, but particularly the Afghan War, have used torture and Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, all this kind of stuff. And it was true. We used torture. But the CIA wouldn't own up to it. The government wouldn't own up to it. The press was all over it. That one they covered well. But nobody would agree that there'd been torture because Americans don't do that. Well, I sit on this committee. I was chairman of it. And we put out, and Ted almost jumped out of the airplane when I told him this, a 6,300-page report on how we had done torture to, you know, purported terrorists. And it passed out of the Intelligence Committee last 2 weeks ago. And the president said he's going to make it available to the American people, which means he's going to. And then the question is, will the CIA redact it, that is, blackout huge portions of it? I don't think they're going to be able to. Because when America makes mistakes, then this is what keeps you going. When America makes mistakes, as we did in our interrogation process, you got to own up to those mistakes. You got to own up to them. That's the way you advance as a country, is when you admit that you did something wrong and the rest of the world doesn't hate you for it. They hate you anyway. They hate you less for it because you owned up to it. And that's a great feeling of progress. Yes, it's cynical up there, but I'm looking forward to next week. Well, the week after that. No, next week, when we're back in session.
Talk, we've got to jump around a little bit and then go to the questions. What time do you want us to, what time do we?
10 minutes.
In 10 minutes or so, all right. Talk a little bit about the danger of cyber warfare and why people need to be conscious of it and where it may lead us.
Anybody shop at Target? Because Target, this is ironical, Target was not careful to put up a defense against, the Chinese, anybody, you, any of you, a 14-year-old in the Philippines who knows his computer, can target like the New York City subway system or the grid system, the electrical system of this country, or Hoover Dam, and they can target it and shut it down through the computer. And it passes through servers and all kinds of places, and it's a very hard thing to do, but it's now a known science. So what we have to do in this country is put up defenses for industry so that they keep some of the things they've discovered. They keep their patents. Their patents are now just being stolen. I mean, Target, 170 million people gave up all their healthcare information, all of their prescription drug information, everything about themselves. And the nation was shocked. Well, you know what the National Security Agency is, the NSA? You've been hearing all the bad stuff about how the NSA collects a lot of material. But nobody, because we built so many Chinese firewalls to protect it, nobody has ever come to me, and I say publicly, find one person and give me his or her telephone number who feels they have had their privacy violated by the NSA. I've never had an answer to that.
How would we know?
We would know because they would all of a sudden have nothing in their bank account.
No. I'm saying if the NSA, for reasons, I don't know, simply for purposes of collecting information, if the NSA has been tapping into my phone so that at an appropriate time in the future, when they choose to, they know enough about me that they can influence
me. When they tap into your phone, they have no content. If they tap into your computer, they have no emails.
I'm sorry, why is that?
It's just the law. It's just they don't do it.
Well, if I was totally confident that everybody was abiding by
the law. Well, there are plenty of people who are watching over them, including the FISA court. I mean, it gets complicated, but there's a lot. We constructed a very, very strong firewall to protect people from having that happen.
Talk for a moment. You sort of skimmed over it so quickly that I fear a lot of folks out here may not have heard exactly what you said. It may be that with a cyber attack, such an attack could be launched against one of our major power grids.
Yes.
What that would mean is that the electricity in an entire region would be knocked out, not for a day, not for a week, but potentially for a month or two. Mm-hmm. Just think for 30 seconds about all the things you could not do if the electricity was out in your region. You can't flush the toilet. You turn on your tap, there's no water. You turn on the light switch, there's no light. You turn on the radio, there's no signal. All gone. No heat in the winter, no cooling in the summer.
And no computers.
And no computers. Try texting each other when the power is out and you can't recharge your phone. You know, and those are things, you know, the senator said a moment ago to talk about, you know, media. And what troubles me so much about the fact that the media focuses more on what we think you want to hear than on what we think you ought to hear. The American public ought to be hearing about the impact, the potential impact of cyber attacks on our infrastructure. You should be hearing about that every day, not what happened to that Malaysian airliner. Sorry.
No.
Your turn.
And the thing is that industry, again, this Olympia Snow, this wonderful Republican from Maine, who she just had it. I mean, her husband was governor of Maine, and she was busy, and I think she was tired. But she was absolutely wonderful. And she and I put together, 4.5 years ago, we put together a cybersecurity bill, which has not moved one inch. Now, why is it not moved? It has not moved because industry thinks that the government is going to come in and tell them what they have to do. That is wrong. It is totally voluntary. The government does set standards because you have to have certain standards that everybody has to live up to, or else this corporation has a huge advantage over this corporation. So there has to be equality throughout the system. But the government does not say you have to do anything, that you have to participate, but it says if you are going to, this is what you can do. It's in the interest of every corporation. In fact, I did something, Ted, which was kind of crazy. many things that were kind of crazy, but there's something called the Security and Exchange Commission, and this is interesting, and nobody knows it, and I never said anything about it. I couldn't get any movement on the bill, so I called up the head of the Security and Exchange Commission, a wonderful lady named Mary Shapiro at the time, and I said, will you just get your people to pass a rule that every time any corporation or entity, public or otherwise, is broken into, hacked into by cybersecurity, that they have to report that to the SEC website so that the shareholders of that company will know. I did the same thing with coal mine safety because I couldn't get any progress on that. Now, anytime something happens, they have to send that information to the SEC so that people know, are people living up to their responsibilities to keep coal miners safe and to keep Americans and companies safe. It's a very complicated world, and it needs you. It needs you. I mean, I want and pray, literally, that I will help start a process. I was the first Rockefeller to become a Democrat. You know, so what? Now everyone's a Democrat, you know. But their children, some of them, are Republicans. You know, I mean, that's the way it works. But bite your teeth into something hard. Get outside of your comfort zone. Go somewhere and spend 3 or 4 months in a place which is uncomfortable, where there's no running water, where you have to squat on the ground to go to the bathroom. But the people are fantastic. They give you all their food. They give you their love. But get out of your comfort zone. Understand what the rest of the world is like. Understand what the rest of your country is like. When I went to Emmons, West Virginia, it was like, you know, I'd never seen that before in my life. And yes, I'd had a privileged life. But it fundamentally changed me. And it gave me a direction in my life that I had been seeking for a long, long time. That's what I was in Japan, China, what was I going to do? I wanted it to be meaningful. It was Emmons, the people of West Virginia, who inspired me to go to work like crazy for them. And I keep in touch with them all the time. So a lot of them are beginning to die off now. But there's nothing like giving to other people. It's nothing like making yourself uncomfortable, but you know that you're doing it for a good purpose. There's nothing more important than learning about the other people in this country and in this world who are wonderful, smart, educated, motivated, and struggling with all their might just to get through the next day.
And if you look at the extraordinary career of this man, and all of you whom he has touched, whether you know it or not, directly or indirectly, the impact that he has had in intelligence and foreign policy and health and education. I have a friend who says that modesty is just arrogance waiting to pounce. But Jay Rockefeller is a genuinely modest man. But the life that he has led is an exciting life. And the notion of getting into public service is an exciting adventure. It's gotten a bad rap over these last few years because our politicians are so worried about getting reelected that they end up doing foolish things, engaging in more partisanship than they should. But public service is a brilliant career path and an exciting life. And you have here a man who exemplifies the very best of that. So before we go to your questions, why don't you express your appreciation to him?
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much. And I miss you all very much, and I miss Wesleyan all the time.
Anytime.
Oh, can I tell one story?
Of course.
Of course.
Did I get my phone call to Chuck Percy? Did I use that?
You're the boss.
Did I use that?
Of course.
Have I said it?
No, not here.
Madam President, I loved it so much here, but I was faced with the idea, and this was actually a critical point in my life, but I loved it. I loved dealing with the students. I loved going to the student councils. I loved trying to resolve problems. Sometimes I hate to say it, but you had to kick people out of school, and if you didn't kick people out of school, the morale of the classroom went down because they knew who should belong there and who shouldn't be there. But I liked it so much that although I was planning on getting back into politics, I called up Sharon's father, who was a United States Senator named Charles Percy from Illinois, and I said, Chuck, I think I'm out of politics. I think I want to stay in higher education. That, in turn, caused me to do the most profound thinking about where I could do the most good. And it was close, but I opted for the public policy and all the junk that goes along with it.
Both have its challenges.
Yep.
Thank you very much. And we do have, if anybody else wants to fill out their card and bring it down really quickly, we'll be glad to accept those right down here in the front. And in the meantime, I believe Ted may have to leave about 3:30 or so. Okay, so we'll go proceed with questions. So go right ahead.
All right, let's start. Pat, you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation of your last name. Can you yell it out? Is it Fulmine?
Facemine.
Pat Facemine.
Good Braxton County name.
I grew up in Long Island, New York. My family seriously thought I was crazy when I went to West Virginia and later moved permanently to West Virginia. What was your family's reaction when you told them you were going to join Vista and be housed in Edmonds, West Virginia?
Well, I'll tell you this. For the first 5 years that I was in West Virginia, I promise you, my father thought I was living in North Carolina. And that was okay with me. That was okay. No, I mean, I was doing something, I mean, it was sort of like becoming a Democrat. I was doing something that I clearly wanted to do, that I believed in, and in life, including theirs, that's what counted.
If you were an enrolling freshman, what degree would you choose to study now?
Probably music. As some of you know, I'm an enormous Johann Sebastian Bach fan, a Baroque fan. I really take it seriously. I really work hard at it, and I spend a lot of time on the piano. But I think I'd do exactly what I did. I'd major in history.
History?
Yeah.
What the hell do you do with a history degree?
You read a lot of books.
You don't need to go to college to do that. You can read books.
Well, okay. Iran is a problem, right?
Right.
Do you know the best book ever written on Iran? I gave a copy to every member of the Intelligence Committee, and it cost $35 a book, and I was sort of ticked off about that. It's 800 pages, so you can't just sort of dabble at it. You commit yourself to it for however long it takes you to read it. You will know more about Iran, about our history there, about their views about us, vice versa, than you will ever learn from any lecture other than going over and living there.
What's the name of the book?
It's called The Persian Puzzle, because Iran is not, after all, an Arab country. It's a Persian country. Persian Puzzle, 800 pages.
It's interesting. I mean, we were talking a moment ago about media, what it doesn't do and what it ought to be doing. How many of you here have any sense at all of why it is that the Iranians, and really the Iranian people, love Americans? They genuinely do. I've spent a lot of time in Iran. But they really despise our government. How many of you have any sense of what it is we did to Iran that causes them? Go ahead, sir. Tell them. I'm sorry?
We decided
they didn't need democracy. That's a good way of putting it. We decided they didn't need democracy. In 1953, the Iranians had a free election, and they elected a prime minister who then proceeded to nationalize the Iranian oil and gas industry. And the United States didn't like that, and the British didn't like that, and MI6, the British intelligence agency, and the CIA conspired with elements of the Iranian military to overthrow Mohammad Mossadegh, who was then the prime minister of
Iran.
And
to assassinate him.
And, well, they didn't assassinate him. He was under house arrest for about 2 years, and then he died. Maybe we did assassinate him. Who knows? You're on the intelligence committee. You know a hell of a lot more. You know a lot more about that than I do. But in any event, the Iranians have never forgotten that.
Right.
Never forgotten that. Just as we, I mean, take a look at it now when you consider part of what's going on at the moment. We, the United States, the White House, has just denied entry, a visa, to someone that the Iranians put forward as their ambassador to the United Nations. We denied him a visa because back in 1979, when the Americans were taken hostage at the U.S. Embassy there, this guy was then an interpreter for the students who had, the radicals who had taken over the embassy. Well, you know, if we're ever going to get along with the Iranians, we're going to have to ease up a little on what happened in 1979. They're going to have to ease up a little on what happened in 1953. But we, as a people, need to understand. We need to know what's going on. We need to be informed. What do you feel was one of the most important decisions you made in your political career? This is Phyllis Costin.
I think it was to stay the course. It was, I have been in public life in West Virginia, with the exception of 3 years at Wesleyan, for 50 years, which is one third the life of the entire state of West Virginia. And I think that there were many times that I could have done something else, but I never came close to finding anything else that was as absorbing to me, as interesting to me, as challenging to me, as doing public, something called public policy in education and mental health, dental health, all kinds of things. I couldn't let go of them. I didn't want to. So I was staying the course. I think that's the answer.
And the final question from Brett Miller, class of 06. It's really a two-parter. What is your fondest memory of your time as president of West Virginia Wesleyan College, and what role did the college play in your future political and public life?
Two very interesting questions. I think the first one is humorous. My father, who did finally understand that I was in West Virginia, came down, and when I was sworn in as the new president, he gave a speech in which he said, "Huh, Jay finally has a job." And the second part was what?
Well, the second part was, what role did it play in college
huge.
In your future
huge.
Political
It was huge.
Political.
I did not know it at the time, but it was huge, because this is a Methodist college. I was born a Baptist. I became a Presbyterian because I couldn't find a Baptist minister in Charleston that I wanted to go here every Sunday. I did find a Presbyterian one. And I was on the board at the University of Notre Dame while I was at Wesleyan. And I think it was just I was at peace with myself. I was at peace with the world. I didn't care a whole lot what people thought about me if I had a good feeling about what I was doing.
Unless someone has a nasty question to throw at either one of us. Oh, here. Nasty questions?
Nasty as we can
find. All right. Let's see. How did you meet up with Sergeant Shriver? Were you working together? What key conversation? Could we shift that currently? Wait a second. What key conversation or conversations could we shift that currently exist to transform our state, country, world into working together?
It's not impossible to do. He did it so easily because he did it in the 4 years after the Kennedy election. And if you want to know what really turned me into a Democrat, it was having to choose between Kennedy and Nixon. And that was my first vote, and it wasn't a hard one. But the real point is that it isn't that hard to shift back towards a society that gets along. You do it here by definition of the nature of what Wesleyan is. I'm going to go to WVU tomorrow. That's a much bigger place, more diffused with many more problems, et cetera. But when you get down to it, Americans are not sophisticates. We're people that come from communities all over the place. And I remember when I was governor, we had floods all the time. And especially in southern West Virginia, and I'd have to open up the National Guard armories so that people could spend overnight all the time. Nobody ever showed up. They never showed up to the National Guard armories. Why? Because cousins were taking in cousins and friends were taking in friends, and that's just the kind of people we are. Now, if we're that kind of people and have all the economic problems that we do, if we can catch some breaks and if we can diversify our economy, so that the whole deal isn't the psychology of coal or the hating of Obama, but rather thinking about ourselves and what is really good for us. There are unbelievable things happening in technology in West Virginia. In fact, coming from the airport, you refused to drive in the car with me, so you had your own driver, but you passed a yellow painted, and you'll know this one, Pam, a yellow painted clapboard house, which looks like a farmhouse. Inside that house, there is an absolute treasure trove of complex computerized this, that, servers, all kinds of things. I mean, it's a thriving small business. And one of the things I'm going to do tomorrow is Google has made available, and this tells you something about West Virginia. In Charleston, they made available a class for people who had never really done the computer enough. So there were quite a few retired people, but a lot of people younger than that, that showed up more than it ever showed up for anything that Google had done anywhere in the country. In one of the small states in the country. And so they want to do it again tomorrow in Morgantown. And it's just simply, how do you put up a website? How do you keep it up there? They'll pay for it for the first year, but they won't for the second year. But you're going to be hooked by the time the second year comes around. And you need that business. And if you're running a small business, you need to get out from you know, Here's our product. You got to put it online. If you don't put it online, it doesn't exist. And so we're going to do that tomorrow. That's exciting. It's happening in West Virginia, and it will be a huge success.
You've already begun to answer this last question, but let me read it anyway, because any of you who saw this article yesterday know that it's so relevant. There was an article in yesterday's New York Times titled, 50 years into the war on poverty, hardship hits back. It focused on McDowell County and how it hasn't changed much, since President Kennedy's visit. What do you see as possibilities for West Virginia's economic and holistic health over the next 30 years?
Well, I mean, I'll give you an example. It's not a very impressive one. When I was governor back in the 70s and 80s, I couldn't figure out. McDowell County at that time still is the poorest county in the state, but a wonderful county. It was a billion-dollar coal field county. It had all the coal in the country, but it was all gone, and the people had nothing to do. And so I called a meeting of the county commissioners of McDowell County and Wyoming County, which is also one of the poorest counties. And I said, I have no idea what I'm going to do, but I am going to bring industry to your two counties, which had my neck on the line, right? That's part of the joy of this, when you have your neck on the line and you've got to come through. And so I'm not enormously proud of this, but it was needed at the time. We got a huge federal prison, which we did not have in West Virginia, except the old one, which is now a museum, I think, or something, up in Moundsville. And it employed 300 people. It was state-of-the-art. It actually employed probably 600, 700 people because of all the ancillary services. And it changed the face of McDowell County for a while. I also built a hospital down there, which changed the face of that county. In Wyoming County, we weren't quite as successful. We did bring in some industries. But if you put your neck on the chopping block and say you're going to do something, there's a lot of fun in having to get it done. And if you fail, you fail. Part of the deal. But try not to. Please get into public service in some form, okay? And then say, that's teaching, that's being a nurse, that's being an EMT, that's firefighter, everything. It's not just called an elected political office. It's called serving your community in some way. You'll never regret it.
50-some-odd years in television have taught me that you always want to leave them laughing, right? So you mentioned a moment ago that in 1960 you had the chance to vote for Kennedy or Nixon, mm-hmm. and you opted to vote for Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can explain why. In 1972, I was with President Kennedy in China, and we went out to the Great Wall. And one of my colleagues walked up to President Nixon, who was a very smart man, mm-hmm. but not much good at small talk. And my colleague shoved a microphone in the president's face and said, Mr. President, what do you think about the Great Wall? And President Nixon replied, well, one can only say. And for the younger among you, that's a pretty damn good Nixon impression. One can only say, upon looking at this wall, that this is truly a great wall. Swear to God. So on the flight from Beijing down to Shanghai, I started thinking about all the things that the president's staff, president has a big staff could have come up with something. And in my fevered imagination, I wrote this song that I would have had President Nixon sing. And I'm going to sing it to you now as a way of getting us off stage. It's a grand old wall, it's a long-standing wall, wins the prize for its size and its age. It gave just rewards to the Mongol hordes, drove the kulaks away in a rage. From Beijing to the seas, it has saved the Chinese till the days of the Kuomintang. From Ming to Han and on and on, with the Great Wall, you can't go wrong.
I'm sure each and every one of you are so pleased that you were able to attend today. This was just a spectacular afternoon. I want to thank all of you for coming, remind you that we do have a reception in the Greek room in this facility, and thank you so much for the two of you for what an inspirational afternoon and really a memorable one for all of us. Thank you so much. Small token of our appreciation right here. Thank you.